The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more.
Welcome back to the programme, and we are now going to have a look. There is a lot of coverage, as you would expect today, on the whole Ukraine situation and Russia and Mr. Putin and Europe and what Europe is and isn't doing. And we will have a look at some of that coverage. But first of all, I want to talk to Bill Browder, who's CEO of Hermitage Capital. And you spoke to us on the programme about a year ago, I do believe. And you also spoke to a joint committee on foreign affairs and trade within the context of the Irish Parliament. Now, that's a very, very, very long intro. But what I would like, if you could, Bill, first of all, good morning to you, and thank you for coming on the programme. Just remind people what you were trying to do and the background to the Magnitsky case.
Sure. In really quick terms, I was at one point the largest foreign investor in Russia. I discovered corruption in the companies I invested in, started exposing it. The government, this was now like 8 years ago, the government expelled me from the country, declared me a threat to national security, raided my offices, seized my documents. I hired a young lawyer named Sergei Magnitsky to investigate what they were going to do with the documents, and he discovered the documents were used to perpetrate a massive fraud, not against me, but against the state, in which they stole $230 million. These were government officials stealing from their own country. Sergei testified against the officials. They then arrested Sergei, put him in pretrial detention, tortured him for 358 days, and killed him at the age of 37 in November of 2009. I was in Dublin at the Parliament because I've been working on a piece of legislation which has been implemented already in America, and I'm trying to get it in Europe, called the Magnitsky sanctions, named after my lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, which would impose visa sanctions and asset freezes on the Russian officials who are involved in killing Sergei and those who do similar types of things to other people.
And furthermore, after he died or was killed, as you say, and they took a case against him.
Well, that's probably the most shocking thing. So after these sanctions became implemented, they put him on trial, along with me. They put him on trial 3 years after he died and prosecuted him in the first ever trial against a dead man in the history of Russia. Not even Stalin did that, which tells you a couple things. One, it tells you how bad these people are, but it also tells you how scared and crazy they got with the idea that their assets might be frozen in the West, which brings me to a point we'll make later in our conversation.
And when you look at what's happening in Ukraine and you look at the move by Putin, Do you not in any way attribute some small bit of blame, say, to the Europeans not respecting the sensibilities there?
Well, no, I don't see that at all. I mean, Ukraine is a peaceful, sovereign neighbor of Russia. Ukrainian people, not the Europeans, the Ukrainian people decided they didn't want a corrupt dictator. And we've seen how corrupt he is when you look at his house. And I'm sure everyone's seen those pictures of a $300 million house belonging to a guy on a state salary of $100,000. And the people said, enough is enough. We don't want to live in destitute poverty so a few guys can steal all the money. And they had a revolution. And it wasn't a European revolution. It was just a revolution about not wanting to have a corrupt dictator. The trigger was this decision for Ukraine not to join Europe, but that wasn't what this was all about. The Europeans have nothing to do with this thing. This is a Ukrainian revolution, and the Russians then decided to invade Ukraine after the revolution.
You were a supporter of Putin's, weren't you?
When Putin first came to power after the oligarch years of Yeltsin, I was hoping that he was going to come in and restore order and get rid of the oligarchs. Instead, what Putin did was become the biggest oligarch, and when that became clear, we fell out, and I'm now probably his biggest critic in the West.
And you got great support for the Magnitsky. I really apologize for pronouncing
Magnitsky.
That.
Magnitsky
Act. I mean, within the United States. Where else did you get support for that?
Well, interestingly, I got support. So it's a pretty simple thing. So we're saying freeze the assets and ban the visas of evil, corrupt Russian officials. And if you go around and ask anybody, should we allow torturers and murderers into our country? Nobody's going to say yes. And I went around America. I went around Europe. I have a bunch of Irish politicians. Jim Walsh is one of the biggest supporters of this thing. But the trouble is, the guys who don't want to do this are the guys who sit in the foreign ministries and the foreign office and the State Department of any country because they don't want to have any trouble with the Russians. And so I've got support. There's not a politician, an elected politician, that will lose a vote anywhere in Europe for banning Russian tortures and murders, just the governments that are worried.
You wanted to come in on that very point, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, the Irish Rockets actually took up this point, and they held hearings, and Bill came over for those. And there was suggestions of Ireland coming up with a Magnitsky list in conjunction with other European countries. And we very blatantly were simply blackmailed then by the Russian embassy here in Dublin, who wrote a letter to the Rockets saying that if this was proceeded with, they threatened the joint bilateral adoption agreement with Russia, and adoption being a big and sensitive issue, as we're all aware. The Oireachtas pulled out of that.
As bluntly as that.
And that's exactly what happened in the US as well. I mean, one of the steps that Moscow took immediately after the passing of the act in the US was to ban US Russian adoptions as well, yeah.
I mean, this is good 19th century old-fashioned power politics where threats work.
Yeah. There is a history, though, there with Crimea and Ukraine, and we were talking about it last week on the programme as well, that Kiev at one stage was the capital of Russia before Moscow. And I don't know if there's that much respect in the West for the history of the Russians. I see you smiling, Colm.
Well, as I understand it, that was in the 13th or 14th century. So if we're going to start to understand modern states and societies on the basis of how they were made up
we go back to 1169.
We do indeed, but I don't think we pay that much regard to it. I mean, I think one of the crucial points is that it is for the people of Ukraine to decide how Ukraine should be governed and not for anybody else. And trying to, you know, that's interesting culturally. I mean, it explains why there's a lot of common culture between Ukraine and Russia, and that it's not simply related to the Soviet era, that it goes much deeper than that. But that's a reason for two states and societies to cooperate, not to be in direct conflict with each other. Crimea, of course, is a little bit more complicated. Crimea was handed over to Ukraine by Khrushchev
as
in the 1950s as a gift.
Yeah.
And even then it's interesting because when you look at the demographics of Crimea, the 60% Russian-speaking population, many of them are either the descendants of or members of the Black Sea Fleet, or, you know, so they're very related to the Russian military forces over there. And indeed, the indigenous population of the Crimean Peninsula were dispersed under the Soviet era and banned. They only
Stalin deported them under force.
They only
returned
in the 1980s.
Plus,
we
shouldn't obsess on the language issue. It's not just a language distinction. There's also a huge age issue here, in which many younger Ukrainians, whether they're Russian-speaking or Ukrainian-speaking, look to the West, look to Europe for opportunities in the future. Whereas many of the older folks, whether they're Russian-speaking or Ukrainian-speaking, they look to what they see as the security and the stability of the Soviet era. So there are lots of complications. There are always complications, and history is complicated. But let's not lose sight of the fact that Russia has invaded, occupied, and is currently proposed to annex part of another country in Europe.
Phil Browder, can I go back to you? Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, you were coming in. Yes?
Yeah, I wanted to say something, which is that there's a lot of the Russian spin on this thing is that somehow this is to do with some special Russian interests, that there's Russian language people, they're protecting Crimeans, they're et cetera, et cetera. I just want to point out something which is sort of the elephant in the room, which is not being paid attention to in most editorials and discussions, which is I don't believe this has anything to do with Putin's desire to protect Ukrainians or Crimeans or anything like that. Putin was basically running a kleptocracy for the last 14 years, where about 1,000 people were stealing all the money from the state. And it kind of worked for about the first 10 years. But it isn't working now. People are getting angrier and angrier in Russia, just like they were in Ukraine, about all the stealing that's going on and how these officials were worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, which they just couldn't possibly have done other than through crime. And people were saying, enough is enough. And Putin had a very difficult choice, which was, how do you stop a restive population from overthrowing him if he's stolen and he and his guys have stolen so much money? And they came up with the tried and true method, which is, start a war to distract everybody, And that's what this is all about. Putin is not interested in Ukraine. He's interested in making sure that people are not looking at him and his money and his cronies.
You wanted to come in there, Helen.
Yeah, it's a very, very complex situation. I think that what we see is that President Putin is regaining in popularity at the moment. And that's very important for him at this point in time. From a strategic point of view, Crimea is absolutely essential to
the port.
Yes, of course. And there are 400 ships. There are Russian ships. So, I mean,
nobody was taking those ships away.
But the Russians, nobody taking that away. I know, but the Russians don't want to give up Crimea. But what I just want to say is that I think the stance anyway today of the West and Europe, and I know that President Hollande was on the phone in the same way as David Cameron was on the phone to President Obama. I think there's a lot of discussions. Nobody wants to enter a second Cold War. At the same time,
or a hot war.
Well, or a hot one, yeah, but a cold one to start with. And what everybody wants to see is that the integrity of the Ukraine being protected. What we see there is a revolution which is very similar to what happened in other countries. Moderate people start, peaceful demonstrations are taking place. People want democracy, they want to get rid of corruption, they take to the streets. And then there are more radical elements coming in. And I think we need to be very careful today not to mix the wish for the Ukrainian people to want democracy, to want to be able to elect the people that will be representing them, and those radical extreme right fascists that have come into the movement, because we've seen that in other countries and other crises.
I think we have to be very careful, though, if we're going to talk about the 3 months of conflict in Ukraine, we need to be very careful not to be suggesting that on the side of the protesters there's a significant radical or neo-Nazi influence. I mean, anybody who's watched that conflict and seen all of the imagery and all of the evidence that emerged from that, when you saw snipers in uniform firing on unarmed protesters, when you saw, I mean, just the level of violence and the response of the state to those protests was so extreme. Of course, we need to look at the political makeup of the current Ukrainian government. And there are concerns about the extreme politics of some elements of that government now. But that's an issue that the Ukrainian people also need, and there will be elections and they need to make those decisions. But, you know, those protests started off as peaceful protests. The way that they were responded to certainly inflamed the situation there. There's no doubt about the fact that elements of the protests responded violently as well to the attacks that they were subjected to. But when you saw what was happening, I mean, just go online and look at the imagery of that protest. When you see unarmed protesters holding up sheets of metal trying to protect themselves as they move around the place, homemade shields, and being picked off by snipers.
Mm. When 100 people died in a peace in
those
protests.
And we've seen no accountability or
nothing whatsoever. That's why there were three foreign ministers who went into...
Including France.
Yes, absolutely. And what Laurent Fabius described to me was that when they came in the morning, there were people being shot from those snipers hiding on the roofs.
But we have to be careful about not feeding that Russian narrative that there is some kind of civil conflict in Ukraine. That the Russians can contribute to the solution.
That's what I said. They're part of the problem. I know, that's what I said. We shouldn't mix those things and just focus on the extremists. We have the great majority of the Ukrainian people who just want democracy, and we need to accompany them. Mm. And that's what we do.
Okay, can I go back to you, Bill, because I know that you'll be leaving us at 12. How do you see matters into the future, and how would you like to see them? And what would you like as a response, rather than just a knee-jerk response?
Well, first of all, I think that anybody who thinks that just by talking nicely to Vladimir Putin, he's going to withdraw his troops from Crimea and we're all going to go back to historic borders, we'd all love that for it to happen, but that's just naive to think it's going to happen. That's not how Putin operates. He operates on a prison yard mentality, which is you can never show any sign of weakness. And in his idea, in his worldview, showing any type of settlement or compromise is a sign of weakness. So that's not going to happen. So I think we have to safely assume that Crimea will be annexed to Russia in some way, shape, or form. Then we have to decide in the West, are we going to accept that as the new status quo? Is it going to be okay for Russia to go to peaceful neighbors and invade them and take over their territory? I'm praying that the leadership in Europe is strong enough, and the leadership in America is strong enough to say that is a red line. you know, they said they talked about red lines in Syria, and they let them, they let everybody cross them. This has got to be a red line. You cannot allow for Russia to take over peaceful foreign neighbors.
And how do you do that?
Well, you don't have to. You don't have to send troops in. That's ridiculous. But what you can do, and coming back to my thought about what this is all about, if this is about Putin and his kleptocracy, and I believe it is, then there's one easy, very simple policy tool, which comes back to my own story and case, which is that the guys have a lot of money in Russia who have done this. These people are not like the Soviets, where they were living in their own Soviet world. They do all this nasty stuff in their country, and they take all this money that they've gotten, and they keep it in the West. And so that's the Achilles heel of Putin and his regime right now, is their money in the West. And if you go after their money in the West, if you impose asset freezes and visa sanctions against the people who invaded Ukraine and the people in Putin's regime who are responsible for this, you can't imagine how much that's going to upset them. And that's not a huge, dramatic policy step to take. And it's not a step that you take against the Russian people. You do not impose trade sanctions against Russia as a country, because most of the people there have a dictator that they're not even happy that he's invaded Ukraine. You do it against the people themselves who did this. And I guarantee you, that's a better deterrent for future expansion than any nuclear deterrent.
Okay, Bill Browder, listen, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And now I'm going to go to the newsroom and John Finnerty. Thank you very much indeed. And now, just, we were going to go on with the conversation about Ukraine, but just, I know that, Minister, you're going now. That Malaysian airline disappearance, obviously a matter of worry for you. You've got four citizens.
Yes, yeah, a family, a mother with their two children, and then the friend of one of the children. So I've had a very busy weekend, you know, setting up the opening phone lines to support the family, but also a lot of French people concerned, as there are a lot of French citizens in that area of the world. And of course, they thought that maybe one of their family or friend,
course,
whatever,
yes,
was on the plane.
Yeah.
So we opened phone lines to be able to give, you know, answers and reassure those that were worried. And we've also put in place psychological support for the children of the school, because those three were in the French school in Beijing. So for their pals, we'll be missing them on Monday.
Yeah.
We've put in place
support.
It's really
mysterious, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. They were
talking about were terrorists behind. That's the lead story in the Sunday Telegraph, because there were people with false.
Well, it's just the plane disappeared, and we have no explanation as to how and where that happened. Just before I came in, I had a piece of news saying that there were some elements floating south of Vietnam, so in the sea, that may be parts of that plane. So we may start having an answer as to what happened, but it's shocking. It's 239 people on board, just disappearing, and it's all of those that are still waiting, hoping, and until we have an answer, and that's what we're working on, to try to give them an answer as to what happened. That will put an end maybe to their anguish, not their sadness,
not
but their anguish.
Sadness. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen. Thank you very much, indeed. Listen. Good luck at the match next week.
Okay, I'm going to put on the jersey.
Don't out shout the Thánaiste, okay? Because we need all the volume we can get. Now, I want to go back to Ukraine and the coverage on it. And Dennis Corboy, who is former ambassador from Europe to Washington, is on the line. Dennis, you have connections and for years within that world surrounding Russia and the newly independent states.
Well, good morning, Marion.
Morning,
yes,
to you.
I was posted in Georgia and Armenia in the 1940s when we were, in the 1990s, sorry, when we were putting together the post-Soviet situation, when these countries were becoming independent states. And I still have maintained my contacts there, because I run this policy institute at King's College London, and been involved in that. So, but it's a troubling situation because it's a dare really to the EU and to the US as to whether Putin can continue this. It's a gamble. He's gambled that he can invade wherever he likes in the former Soviet space. and that the West will just huff and puff, as in the case now in Crimea. But what's most worrying is this: the justification for the invasion, which is that it's on the basis of a doctrine that Moscow has the right to protect Russian citizens who feel threatened in any part of the Soviet space. This is very troubling for other countries, because remember, at the moment, Russia is occupying part of three countries, Georgia, Moldova, and now Ukraine. This is a very destabilizing influence. It's not to speak of a violation of the United Nations Charter, but in the case of Ukraine, it's in violation of the Budapest Memorandum and, of course, the document setting up the OSCE. So it's a very troubling thing. And to my mind, the most important thing is that the EU and the US must be credible. And it's a much bigger price for the EU has to pay than the US, because the people who will have to come up and pay the price are Russian businessmen and people of the City of London, if there are to be genuine, credible sanctions, which, of course, were agreed last week, sort of targeted gradual sanctions along the way. But if these are not credible, then I think we're in for a very unstable future. And I think it's very disturbing, because the post-Cold War order, as we call it, in Europe is now completely disturbed. And we'd have to get back to something that we can live with.
Well, I don't know if you heard much of our previous interviewee, but he was the man that campaigned.
I missed Bill Broder, but I can just imagine what he was saying.
Yeah, and he was suggesting that kind of targeting of a very serious money. But when he was talking to our parliamentarians here, that we were threatened with retaliation in the form of the adoption laws, and successfully so. So if you take how dependent we are on gas coming from that part of the world, presumably that's going to be at the back of people's minds in terms of self-interest.
It'll all be in the mix. And if we want to have a safer Europe, we have to pay a price. That's my point. But we must be credible. There's no use in threatening and not actually falling through, because Putin doesn't believe that we're going to do anything. Mm. And that puts in danger other... I mean, think if you're in Moldova, or even if you're in the Baltic states, which are now within the European Union,
yes,
and NATO for that matter. But if you were in Estonia, they've also threatened there that there are ethnic Russians who need to be protected. This is a perversion of the right to protect doctrine of the United Nations. So I think we must take a stand. Unfortunately, there will be a price to be paid, and I don't want to put a tooth in it. The money laundering operations in the City of London will be suspended for a while, but there is a price. And are we prepared to pay the price? Putin believes we're not.
Is he right? Can I just come to you? Agree?
Absolutely.
You agree? He believes we're not.
He believes we're not. He may have been slightly taken aback by the rhetorical force. He's definitely been taken aback, I think, by the diplomatic response that he's gotten. But that has got to be followed up with tangible sanctions that impose a price on Russia. And as Dennis is saying, it will inevitably impose a price on Europeans in terms of gas, in terms of industry, even in our little case, in terms of adoption. There are lots of issues that will impose, which will impose pain. But otherwise, you know, you feed this tiger once, that tiger is going to get hungry again.
Yeah. How are things in South Ossetia now?
Well, he has. It's now really a Russian province, South Ossetia. I mean, they've got Russian passports and so forth. It's a very hard situation to see what you can do about it. But what's happened in Crimea is a repeat of what happened in 2008. And we all said in 2008, the commentariat all said, oh, well, you know, it won't happen again, and it's exceptional circumstances and so forth. But there were always exceptional circumstances. And this is a very troubling situation, and that I very much agree there that it has to be credible. If we threaten something, we must make it credible. And we have to see, if Russia wants to play by the economic order in the world, by the political order in the world. It has to play by the rules. And it's quite as simple as that. If you, as the Russian oligarchs want to own half of
London,
half
south of France,
and God knows where else, well, they just have to be able to play by the normal rules and everything else. So there is a price to be paid. And I have my doubts that we're going to be able to stand up to Putin's gamble.
The European Union is so unwieldy, I suppose, in some ways, because there are so many people that have to discuss things that they could be discussing things from here to kingdom come and never get anywhere.
Much further than anyone had expected, because of the German situation did move and the British slightly. But we have to wait and see.
There was a story in yesterday's Telegraph that Mr. Putin was mocking the West's efforts, and I presume that plays well to the gallery at home. Peter, you want to get...
Yeah, I think this is an interesting and complex part of the world where democratic roots are not deep. And as in so many other areas where there are difficulties, a lot of this goes back to the disintegration of 19th century empires related to the First World War. The German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Tsarist Empire, etc., and the Ottoman Empire. One of the things that happened was a treaty involving the Russians and the Poles called the Peace of Riga. And Ukraine used to be a very much larger country then than it is now. And in that treaty, lumps of what was Ukraine went to Poland, Russia, Belarus and Moldova. Now, if Vladimir Putin is going to come along now and say, well, actually, because there are 60% of the people of the Crimea are Russian, I'm going to take charge of that. What Dennis and others have been saying, the implications are quite severe, because it then goes on into the Baltic states, into other areas that have ethnic Russians in them. And what you do about it is, I'm not sure, but the connections the Russians feel with Ukraine are very deep and very real. For instance, before I started reading up a bit about it, I had no idea that Khrushchev and Brezhnev are both regarded as Ukrainian.
Yeah.
Senior figures in the Ukrainian Communist Party during the Soviet Union era. The Ukraine was a founder member of the Soviet Union. So there are things there that I certainly felt I needed to understand. But I suppose moving on from that, if any world institution or collective has experience in dealing with these complex problems, it's the European Union and the United Nations. Yes, it moves slowly, but you know, the European Union does have form in understanding ethnic conflict, cultural differences,
when you relate,
and building institutions and structures that manage them.
But if you talk about the 19th century, and we were talking about it here last week, the lead up to World War One, and we sort of accidentally tripped into World War One because of this kind of failure of diplomacy, and it's just it's kind of tantalizingly worrying to think that we could do the same stupid thing again, where 10 million people were slaughtered and
this is a part of the world where tens of millions of people have been slaughtered, and after the introduction of the Soviet era and all that, there were two famines which affected Crimea badly. Yeah. Mass deportations of people. It's not an easy part of
that. Ben, you want to come in?
Yeah, and Peter's point is important, because
I mentioned that it's terrifying when you look back on the last war and you see the justification used by Hitler to invade Sudetenland was this ethnic people of your own ethnicity. This is a terribly dangerous doctrine, and I don't think one can exaggerate the potential of this to disrupt the whole order of Europe and of course with consequences that we would have to, it'll be a creeping thing unless we take a stand at some stage. And now it looks like the time we have to take a stand, regrettably.
Ben, you want to come in?
Yeah, just to say that Peter's point raises a contradiction to what Bill was saying earlier on. This isn't just about money and a kleptocracy around Putin. This is part of a much bigger game that Putin and many others in Russia are playing. In a sense, Russia is playing this 19th century game of empire. It's a game that Europe used to play very well, but hasn't for a long time. And in a sense, both sides are playing very different games. And I think, to be very frank, that the European Union needs to reach back and to think about what geopolitics really means. Because Putin is thinking things and devising strategies based on an entirely different rule book to that which the European Union has used to date. And the role of diplomacy and rhetoric, etc., and the building of institutions and cooperation is not a game that Putin wishes to play.
You wanted to come in there, Ursula.
Yeah, I just think we have to go back to the point that it will be very, very important because, you see, he violated international law. You know the way the Ukraine border, he just went in and no matter who's living in the Crimea area, and of course they are always historical for any area of the world. You can always go by history and borders change and everything. But because here he invaded it, there was no real reason for it, just his political, what he's trying to achieve. And I do think it will be extremely important for the Europeans to react really fast, and not, because I do think they've already hesitated probably a little bit too long.
Yeah, even Europe doesn't do fast.
Yes, but I do think in this case they will have to do something a bit faster. And of course we've heard, you know, the way the trade links, like in one of the papers it mentions that 6,000 German companies are, for example, in Russia, and Germany has 35% of its oil and gas imports from Russia, of course, and that will be similar to many other European countries. So it's a very important trading partner. But I do think that we have to protect those countries who are in the buffer zone between the East and the West.
Right. OK, listen, we will leave it there for the moment. Dennis Corboy, thank you very much indeed
thank
for
you
talking
much,
to
us. Nice to hear you.
Thank you. All the best. Thanks. Bye-bye.
1850 715 150.